This is John Bunker of FETCO Trees in Maine. I'm also involved with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and our Apple CSA called Out on a Limb CSA in Palermo, Maine. And you are listening to Cider Chat.
Episode 16. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. This is Rhea Windcaller, your Cider MC. And this is a podcast where we chat with cider makers and people in the cider trade, sometimes that we might not be aware of, but they are equally moving the cider agenda forward for all of us. And this week, we have a very special conversation with John Bunker. And if you don't recognize that name, well, by the end of this episode, this is somebody that you want to be following. He's been around for a while. I mean, a long while in terms of apples and apple trees. So it's really great, and it's a nice segue from last week's episode with Chris Jackson, where we were talking about grafting and apple trees, because it is the season and we're looking at it right now for planting and cider apples. So I want to get to that, but I want to hold the horses just a wee bit. This week, I will be headed to CiderCon. So if you're on your way and listen to this podcast, I hope your travels are nice and easy, that you're finding some awesome cider along the way. If you are, tweet it out to the world and let me know. I'm on Twitter at CiderChat. And I love to see a photo. I will be tweeting that along too. And I'm kind of curious, you know, how are the airlines managing cider? Are they actually introducing that? Are you having that on your flight? When you land in the airport, are you finding cider there? Are you finding it in the stores? I know we're going to be finding it in Portland. So Portland gets a, you know, triple-dipple star, or an apple, I should say, for all the good cider energy that they do. So we're all headed to CiderCon, many of us, and that is the U.S. Cider Maker Association, where they have their annual meeting. They will have workshops, and I talked about it in last week's episode if you want to know the schedules. I will be doing a lot of Facebooking, I expect, you know, unless I get really distracted. Don't hold me to anything. It's amazing that I get this podcast out every week, and I certainly pushed it for you because you are important to me, and I hope that Cider Chat is important to you. And one way to show a little bit of love for Cider Chat actually, it's a whole lot of love. And as we're chatting with John Bunker, I want you to be noticing how much information you are getting out of this podcast. You can't read this in a book. This guy is so passionate. You need to hear his voice and his enthusiasm, and it is contagious. And these are the type of people we want to have showcased out to the world, because they are treasures. Really, truly treasures. If that is important to you, and I know is important to me, please donate to Cider Chat and the podcast now. Any bit will help. As I go out to CiderCon, that is actually on my dime. And so I'm spending a week out there taking the time off to deliver to you, Ciderville, amazing chats with people that really need to have their voices heard, not only because it's an interesting story, but because as you pick up that glass and sip, that you get a better understanding of what's happening. This is history in the making. I mean, the lineage goes back, and you're going to be hearing about that. And I know that some of you are like, oh, crap. I mean, really, God, I just want to listen to the podcast. Podcasters don't stand on their own. It takes a lot of work. So for those of you who are feeling like, oh, it's tough, or just because I love the sound, I'm going to send you this brontosaurus call right now. Don't you love it? All right, let's get to this chat with John Bunker. You know, this guy is amazing. Like he said earlier, he founded FETCO Trees in Maine. He is involved with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardener Association. He is involved and founded Out on the Limb Apple CSA in Maine, and he's also the author of Not Far From the Tree. Just amazing person, so engaging, a true man, a salt of the earth type of gent. I adore him, and I could have spent hours and hours chatting with him. But we're going to just give you a little bit today, and I'll tell you as we go on what we're going to be doing with the rest of the chat. So, are you ready? As I am? Let's grab that glass and join this chat in Concord Public Library in Concord, Massachusetts with John Bunker.
Do you make cider?
Yes, we do make cider.
And I imagine you have a bevy of apples to choose from your area? Or?
Yeah, well, on a year like this, past fall, every apple tree in central Maine was fruiting. And so we had a huge assortment to select from, both in terms of named varieties, grafted trees, but also seedlings. Since Maine is covered with wild trees, they're just everywhere. And so it was a great year to go out and explore for interesting flavored seedlings. We're not a commercial producer at all, and never will be. But my wife and I, Cammy Watts, we both like to make cider and make for a commercial business. We would make a teeny amount. For a household, we make a lot.
That's where I'd like to begin. It's just talking about cider apples and what you're seeing as some of the trends. Certainly here in the U.S. You've been involved in this for quite a while, certainly with Fedco Trees. You're the go-to person for people to consult with and chat with. What have you seen over the years? And so much recently has happened, too. So,
well, when I was younger, shall we say, 40 years ago or so, in my neighborhood, there were many abandoned trees. They were producing a lot of fruit. So I started to learn the names of the varieties, started to collect the fruit. My neighbors taught me the names, some of the names, ones that they remembered. And it quickly became obvious to me that I had way more fruit than I could ever eat. And so the obvious thing to do was to make cider out of it. And so I started to make cider 40 plus years ago, whatever, and mostly sold it in barrels to my friends, because the barrels were really cheap then. They were, you know, $10 a piece or whatever for a wooden barrel. And then also sold it at fairs to vendors wholesale, but fresh. And I thought a lot about the fact that my generation was not planting trees. And I also thought a lot about the commercial orchards I was visiting, because even when I was pretty young, I just loved apples more and more each year. So I would go and visit the commercial orchards just because they were the only people from whom I could learn. And I realized that they were selling their apples for cheaper than they could even produce them. That a lot of them were selling to the applesauce companies for pennies per bushel. And I kept thinking, what would it be? What is the product that every apple in Maine could go into, could be used for, and that the orchardist could actually make an honest living? And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and thought about it, and kept coming back to cider. And it seemed unfair that it would have to be a drug, you know, alcohol, whatever, that would be a way that orchardists could make a living. And I sort of put that on hold, This was probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, whatever. And focused more on encouraging people to plant trees, to plant fruit trees. And so started FEDCO Trees. And
what year did you start FEDCO Trees in?
In 1984.
And, John, when you said you were selling the cider, we're talking about sweet cider.
Yeah, I was selling sweet cider to vendors at particularly at Common Ground Fair, wholesale,
right.
So then they would sell it at their booth. And when I sold hard, you know, fermented cider, hard cider, whatever, I would sell it as to my friends. I'd convince them to buy 50 gallons from me, and then they'd stick it in their basement. And then sometimes they would drink, and sometimes they'd just do nothing with it because they would just be nice.
And you'd sell it in a barrel.
Yeah, I'd sell the whole barrel to them.
Wow.
You know,
how much were you selling that for? Can you remember?
Oh, maybe $1 a gallon. You know,
including the barrel.
Yeah, including the barrel. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I charged them cost for the barrel, which was probably $10.
Oh.
You know, because the barrels were cheap then. But I veered away from trying to save the commercial apple industry. I realized I probably wasn't going to do that, and then. In tandem with starting FEDCO Trees, I hoped, and it turned out I was correct, that selling Max and Cortland's and strawberries and raspberries and whatever would help fund my attempts to rediscover the heirloom varieties. And so we might sell, you know, some rare variety. There's one called Fletcher Sweet, another one called Marlborough, you know. We might sell 10 or 15 of them, you know, virtually nothing.
Yeah.
But it allowed me to track them down, find them, and begin to get them back into the communities. And if the whole catalog had been Fletcher Sweet and Tolman Sweet and Pound Sweet and Marlborough and, you know, whatever, some of these other odd old varieties, we never would have made it. Mm-hmm. So we sold strawberries and raspberries and lilacs and roses and then Honeycrisp and Cortland and Macintosh. And those sort of subsidized the more unusual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out really well. The catalog got bigger, and, you know, first it was just some sheets of paper stapled together, and that eventually became a catalog. And it has I think done a pretty good job at encouraging people, at exposing people to these rare varieties, and help bring them back into circulation or whatever. So and more people were planting trees, and that was great. And to me, it's just as important to plant a lilac as to plant an apple tree. I mean, they're woody plants that will be with us for generations. And they all have their traditions. There's old roses, old lilacs, old, you know, so forth and so on. So then I wish I remembered the date, but it was about 25 years ago or so. I heard about Steve Wood, and all this came back to me of like, oh, you know, making cider, and here's someone who is attempting not necessarily to resurrect a tradition. I mean, we haven't even gone back to what was going on 200 years ago, but someone who was attempting to a different tact on commercial orcharding,
mm-hmm.
and a way to make a living doing it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to mention who Steve Wood is.
Sure.
Steve Wood of Farnham Hill.
Yeah, Steve Wood of Farnham Hill Cider and Poverty Lane Orchards in Lebanon, New Hampshire. So somehow I thought, you know what? Because I knew enough to know that there were certain varieties that were particularly suitable for cider, for fermented cider. And then now I'm going to refer to hard cider just as cider. And so, but I didn't know very much about him. So I contacted Steve, and he said, come on over, whatever. And we had some long phone conversations, and I went over and visited him. And he gave me sort of a primer on what varieties of apples should we be offering, or might we want to offer, if we were going to expand our offerings in the catalog into varieties that would be suitable for cider.
Okay.
So he did that, and we started to sell them. And we didn't sell very many. We sold a few. This was, 15, 20 years ago.
Was that just regional in New England that you were selling?
Well,
what were you seeing back then in the issue of the cider?
Most of our sales, and this was very purposeful on my part, I wanted our catalog to be focused on plants, woody plants, that would do well from roughly, we'll say, Minnesota east and New Jersey north.
Okay.
So we've never, mm-hmm. We have customers in some odd places, the mountains of North Carolina, areas in West Virginia, the high elevations in New Mexico, the high elevations outside Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's places, there's odd little micro regions or around the country that are nowhere near New England but have a similar climate or similar something, and those people have found us over the years. But for the most part, it's the north. It's the greater Northeast, and
not the Northwest.
No, but you know, they have their own nurseries out there that are sort of roughly equivalent to what Fedco's doing.
Okay.
That, and some are doing, you know, are doing an excellent job, but. Although some of the varieties would be the same, you know. But anyway, we started selling primarily English bittersweet varieties, Davinet, Yarlington Mill, so forth, and then Kingston Black, Bitter Sharp, and maybe we'd sell 5 or 6 varieties a year or whatever. We were getting all the signwood from Poverty Lane, Farnham Hill. And then a couple of things happened somewhat more recently.
May I just...
Sure.
Just a second. So you were getting the scion, and the scion, just for listeners who don't know, is the clipping from the tree to graft on to the primary tree. Do you know where Poverty Lane was getting their... Where did they initially get their trees? Were they bringing it from...
I don't know. I don't know where they got their original cuttings.
Yeah.
When and most, maybe some listeners know this, some don't. But an apple tree will not come true to type from seed. So you plant a Macintosh seed, you'll get an apple tree. It will presumably, you know, most of the time, will bear fruit. The fruit could be delicious. Or bitter or anything, but it won't be Macintosh. And you can plant a million Macintosh seeds, none will be Macintosh. And they will be a genetic combination of Macintosh and whoever it was who happened to pollinate that Macintosh. So if you want to replicate an apple, then at that point, it really is sort of when it becomes a variety. And then you replicate it by grafting. And you take a little teeny twig, like about the size of a birthday candle, and you splice it onto an existing tree called the rootstock. And from that splice point onward, you have your variety. You have your Honeycrisp or your Macintosh or your Kingston Black or your Davinet or whatever. After about, we'll say, the Civil War, most apple trees that were being planted were grafted trees. And that's an arbitrary cutoff, but it's approximately right. Before the Civil War, going back to the Mayflower, most trees were planted from seed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the next podcast.
Yes, sure.
But anyway, so, we'll say maybe 10 years ago or so, a couple of interesting things happened. One was a man named Claude Jolicoeur wrote a book called The New Cider Maker's Handbook or something. I think that's what it's called.
The New Cider Maker's Handbook.
Yeah, and Claude began to... He was using in his cider, and he was not a commercial grower, a commercial producer. Mm-hmm. He's a homeowner, amateur, I guess you'd say. He was using mostly sort of American, he lives in Canada, but North American dessert apples, Cortland, whatever, some European bittersweets, I can't remember exactly which ones, but it doesn't matter. And then he discovered three probably apples from seed, wild seedlings, in his area that he felt made really good cider. And these were just wild selections, things that he was finding. Mm. And so he maintained that he now had these three new varieties, you'd say, because he had selected them. They were just wild natural fruit. Mm. And that he thought, this is what Americans might want to be growing and using for their cider, because these are not from Europe. These are from here, from North America. So about the same time, in the mid-Atlantic states, there was...
And do you know what year that was?
It was probably about 10 years ago or not that long ago.
Right. But,
then about the same time, or, you know, in the early 2000s, in the mid-Atlantic states, there was a lot of attention put on two early American varieties that were traditionally used for cider and were revered in early American pomological literature. One is called Harrison, and the other is called Hughes Virginia Crab. And those two apples... unfortunately, in the early American literature, they're reluctant to tell you what an apple was used for. You can find hundreds of pages in some cases about certain varieties, and those would include Baldwin, Northern Spy, you know, Roxbury Russet, Rhode Island Greening, a few other really famous early varieties. But rarely do they say, this was used for this, or this was used for that, which can be very maddening for a researcher or someone who's trying to bring these back, because there were hundreds of varieties, probably, almost certainly, a number of them were used for cider. But it's very hard to sort of tease out that information as to which ones were. There's a few, such as Harrison and Hughes Virginia Crab, or Hughes or whatever, that that we know were used, for cider. So people feel as though they have discovered the real Harrison and the real Hughes, And a number of people, particularly in the mid-Atlantic states, but all over the country, began to talk about, these are the apples that we should be basing our new American cider on. Are these heirlooms, varieties? Mm-hmm. Now, meanwhile, you know, Steve had been doing Farnham Hill sort of in this kind of lonely vacuum. Mm-hmm. And then also at West County, Terry Maloney and Judith Maloney had been doing similar work. So they were sort of like, and a lot of this is now tying in with the early cider days, some of which that history I don't know. But I think they were two of the most important sort of early like callers of like, we should be doing this. Mm-hmm. And Terry... and probably Judith, I know Terry did, I'm not sure if Judith was one of them, I think she was. They went to Geneva, to the huge USDA collection of apples out there, and just started tasting apples in hopes that they would find varieties, because they have a gigantic collection there, that could be new American cider varieties. And meanwhile, there were like little rumblings here and there, like Cider Days and so forth, where people were starting, you know, it's like the rumble before the earthquake was starting to happen with this new thing. And Terry Maloney discovered a variety called Redfield. And Redfield is not an heirloom apple. It is it originated in about 1940 or so, and it is a specific cross. So most of our traditional American varieties are seedlings of unknown parentage. You know, I'm a farmer. It's 1850. I'm out in my field. I an apple comes up along the side. I don't mow it down with my scythe. It produces fruit and it's delicious, so I name it Northern Spy, you know, or whatever. And so it's completely random. But in the 20th century, people began to actually cross different varieties. They take a little dab of pollen and put it on the flower of another one and put a little bag over it, so they'd know what the parents were. One of those of many is Redfield. And Redfield is a cross between an heirloom apple called Wolf River, that many people who know heirloom apples will know, crossed with a Russian variety, which was brought back to the United States by a professor from Dakota, from North Dakota, named Niles Hansen. And he was a very famous American fruit explorer who went all over Russia and other parts of the world. The name of that apple is Needwitskiana, and it is the red-fleshed crab. And all, or virtually all, of the ornamental crabs that you see in anybody's yard that have pink flowers all have Needwitskiana in their parentage. There are different crosses of it, or seedlings of it. So Needwitskiana is really the grandparent, so to speak, of virtually all red-fleshed apples in North America, and it originated in Russia.
And you're saying red.
Red flesh, pink red flesh
versus
good old white or yellow
like a granny,
like every other, like most, almost all dessert apples are. In fact, most apples are white or yellow. So this is, you open it, you know, it's not like, this isn't like halfway. You know, this is red flesh. So Redfield. I don't think anybody knows why they even selected Redfield, except somebody was having fun and did this cross. And there's another one called Red Ford, which is has the same parentage, but Redfield is the more popular. So anyway, Redfield also parenthetically makes a great apple pie, but they taste terrible fresh. So he discovered, you might say, this Redfield. People knew about it, but they weren't using it for cider. It was really mostly an ornamental because it has beautiful pink flowers. But it has this large, ungainly fruit that would mess up your yard. So it never got popular as a ornamental.
All right.
So that was another instance of somebody saying, okay, maybe we don't use European apples. Maybe we use American apples for our new cider revolution or whatever that we hope is going to happen, because they didn't even know it was happening. And Tom Burford, who is really the preeminent apple historian in the United States, and Tom is from Virginia, and Tom was a big champion of Hughes and Harrison. And also, Tom mentioned Ben Davis, which is an apple that was a very popular commercial apple of the 19th century, and has a bad name for its dessert quality and culinary quality. But he suggested, and I never really got the whole story, that either was or could be a really good cider apple as well. So there were these different sort of trends happening, which was the the desire to use the traditional English and also French bittersweets and bitter sharps, which if anybody, if any of your listeners really want to have fun, they should either go to the West Country in England or Normandy and Brittany in France, and they'll have fabulous cider everywhere they go, made from these traditional European bittersweets and bitter sharps. And then simultaneously, there was this whole like movement of like, okay, do we find our apples for our new American cider from our wild seedlings, or from these old heirlooms, or from more modern varieties that never made it, like Redfield, that sort of never made it as a dessert fruit because of their poor fresh eating quality, but have potential. Mm-hmm. I think that there was a period. Meanwhile, there were events like Cider Days, and we'll put in a little plug for Cider Days.
Absolutely.
We love Cider Days.
Yes, love Cider Days. It's the oldest cider fest in the U.S.
Yeah, it's great. And other ones around the country. And then somewhere along the line, some big boys decided that this was enough. There was enough going on, so they needed to needed to get into it. And that part of it I haven't really followed. But, of course, there's Woodchucks, which is not that big now, especially compared to Angry Orchard, and others. And meanwhile, there was a great model. And the model was what happened to beer. And when I was, in my 20s, a craft beer was Guinness, which of course wasn't a craft beer at all, but it was different from the other stuff.
There was no, of course, was exciting. Back then, it was imported from Colorado.
Craft beer, Guinness, but anyway. And so once that took off, and now, there's, 10,000, brands of beer in the U.S. or whatever it is. That took a long time for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And when it began to happen with cider, cider had this whole model, and so it's actually happened a lot quicker for cider.
Yes.
Because they had, there was this whole model. Mm-hmm. And some people, meanwhile, there's like everywhere you look, people are starting to make cider again and going to cider days and doing this and doing that. Still not much in the way of commercial ciders, but the beginnings of it and lots of interest.
You said about when the larger flavors came in, and you're referring to Woodchuck and Angry Orchard. What changed there? Did you see anything in terms of apples in that way? Were they now starting to plant trees?
I would say no. I would say that there's probably some of your listeners know more about this than I do, but I would say that in its largest scale, and this is probably true whether you're making widgets or cider, that you kind of use whatever you can get to produce it, and anyone producing cider on a commercial level until very recently, and they're still struggling with this, with the exception of a few places like Farnham Hill, West County, the late Terry Maloney's place, and a few others, they can use the apples of their choosing because they started 20, 30 years ago. So they've got the apples, or many apples of these varieties that they like. But for the most part, everybody else was, as they began to get into this again, were struggling with what apples to use because if you were into something like Redfield, that line, then you're going to have to graft it. because mm-hmm. you can't find, I mean, FEDCO sold trees, but we, you know, 30 trees a year or something. The English and the French bittersweets, there was, you know, FEDCO sold them, a few other people sold them, but not in huge quantities. No large national nurseries, the really big nurseries, had any kind of supply of them.
Right.
And so I think that a lot of the small cider makers were using, you know, whatever they could find.
Absolutely.
Golden russet, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the large producers, I imagine, but, you know, I don't know for sure, but I imagine they're basically using whatever they can find on the market, either
yes.
national or international.
Yeah.
Now, the value, say, the Angry Orchards, and I'll throw them all into one lump. is that they introduce cider to thousands of
absolutely.
People
absolutely.
Who would have heard of it,
right.
but would have never considered drinking it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we can thank Guinness and Coors and you know, a few other sort of slightly unusual beers for inspiring the craft beer industry. The craft beer makers. So I look at commercial ciders, and some people call them cider soda or what, you know, whatever. I look at them, and some of my cider making friends are very poo poo. Oh, you know, we shouldn't be drinking those and everything, you know, whatever. But I believe that the sort of the rising tide lifts all boats, and the most of the people that I know who are not right in the whole cider industry, mm-hmm. Their introduction to cider is, you know, Woodchuck's, Angry Orchard's, Stella, Artois, whatever.
Right.
And so they know about it now. Mm-hmm. So that when they hear about somebody local that's producing it, it's not this totally bizarre thing. It's actually, oh, I know about that. Okay, let's try that. You know, or I wanna drink something a little more sophisticated. I'm ready. You know, and you have to start somewhere. You know, and so
absolutely.
I think that
and it's changing. You know, what you mentioned, craft beer. If cider follows that same trend with craft beer, you see the Anheuser-Busch, which is owned by InBev. They now are buying up craft breweries all over the map. They've mm-hmm. bought a number of them.
Mm.
And this has also happened with cideries, and they now are really going towards that market that the consumer, it's really about the consumer, has become more educated.
Yeah.
And that's also
yeah.
happening with Angry Orchard and Woodchuck. They brought that up, as you said, and now they are also changing their cider offerings too. Not changing, but actually adding on. And
yeah.
it does. I think that's well said. It does rise up together.
Yeah. Meanwhile, as the cider, you know, movement or whatever began to grow, I think that some cider makers, rightly or wrongly, whatever, they felt kind of strangled by the English bittersweet style.
Mm.
That what right does, you know, so and so have to say that it must be made with European apples,
particular kind of apple,
yeah,
right?
And that seems reasonable, and so what has happened now, I think, is that there are so many cider makers that many of them don't even know about the English bittersweets, and they may never know about them. They're going to be using Wild Seedlings or mm-hmm. Harrison and Hughes or Redfield or some other crab apples. People are using crab apples that they're discovering on people's lawns because many of those have astringent little fruit about the size
tannins.
Of a blueberry, that have the quality. So,
mm-hmm.
so, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's actually a good thing because there will be and I think should be, dozens of different styles of cider. And I know that I have my favorites, and unfortunately...
Can you share what those are? I mean, are you talking about commercial ciders or your own cider style?
Just it could be commercial, it could be mine, it could be, you know, just flavors.
Flavor styles, know. Right.
But the flavor is so entirely personal.
Yes.
And it should be. Right. And, you know, people say, well, is this good cider, is this bad cider? Like, I cringe because, you know, I don't know if you'd really call it good or bad. I just would rather drink this one than that one, or that one than this one, or, you know, whatever.
And Claude mentioned in his book, you know, that there's a gentleman from, I think, Cider Days, who makes a cider every year, and he can't drink it, but the guy who makes it, it's really his palate, and he loves it. So I think that's something that we all have to embrace and not become too critical of each other, because that will only stagnate growth in many ways.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I've been to many, many cider tastings. Most of them have been in people's kitchens, you know, or whatever. Some cider, clearly, everybody in the room agrees, is absolutely horrible. You know, so it is
happens.
Possible.
It
is possible to make something that I don't think anybody's going to like. When it comes to my own cider, I'm just happy if I like it, you know, because it's a long way till next year,
right,
you know.
Right.
So all I want for my cider is that I like it. I don't care if you like it. I just want to like it. But one of the things that is that I began to look for wild seedlings. We have many wild seedlings on our property, wild apple seedlings. So each one unique, you know, not mm-hmm. grafted. Mm-hmm. As do many people
I
know.
Right.
And that is really fun to do. It's really fun to do. It's exciting.
Yeah. Is that what you were calling, like, the heritage, that what you're doing in Maine on the limb?
No, because
that's a little bit different.
Because with the work that I do around heritage apples, what I'm looking for is a variety that maybe someone introduced 100 years ago,
pre-established,
or 200 years ago, or even 300 years ago. What Claude was doing in Canada, mm-hmm. I think what he did was the value of what he did, it might in part be the three apples he discovered. But even more than that, it was that what he said to people was, you know what, if you want cider apples, go out and find them. They're probably growing on your road somewhere. Mm-hmm. Just start tasting the wild apples around you. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful book, very short, by Henry David Thoreau, and it's appropriate that we're sitting here in Concord, mm-hmm. Called Wild Apples, and it is fantastic, and your listeners should all read it. But it's called Wild Apples by Henry David Thoreau. Anyway, what that got me to thinking was that the tradition in New England was to use wild apples in cider. This is probably pre-1820 when the first temperance movements began to come in. And the apples were there. They were there everywhere. They were being grown from seed. If I think that the wild apple I find in my woods is the next Kingston Black or the next Dabinet, I'm probably fooling myself. If I think it might be fun to add it to my cider and see what it does, that's probably a really good thing.
Sure.
But these varieties like Yarlington Mill, Harry Masters Jersey, Mediador, mm-hmm. Dabinet, Kingston Black, whatever, these varieties have been tried and tested and grown in multiple locations. Mm-hmm. For, in some cases, over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And And sometimes I hear people say, you know, oh, I found this bittersweet apple in my woods, and it's going to be the new Dabinette, and we should grow thousands of them. Well, maybe it is, but it probably has a long way to go before we actually get to the point where we're going to say to a commercial cider maker, don't grow 20 acres of Dabinettes, go 20 acres of Bunker's Bitter,
right.
you know, and
that's a good name,
and
yeah, I like it,
and or Bitter Bunker, anyway, whatever. So, I think that it's awesome that people are out there discovering these wild varieties and naming them in many cases and having fun with them and trying them and experimenting and passing them around. And people send me cyan wood, the little twigs, the little birthday candles of all these different wild things they're
nice.
Discovering. And I'm grafting them to see what they'll do.
Sure.
There's a whole process of experimentation that needs to happen. And maybe some of these will wind up being, you know, the beginnings of a new collection of American cider apples. But that's down the road a bit.
Ooh, so much information, and there is a lot of the links and apple mentions on the show notes, so you could go there. A nice photo of John and Kemi Watts at Super Chili Farm in Palermo, Maine. And, it's like an encyclopedia. So there's going to be a second piece, actually three pieces to this. I did talk to John about the apples that Chris Jackson is planning on putting into the soil down in Georgia. And that's the Anatovka apple. And I'm going to put that on this episode 16. So check that out. It's going to just be an additional clip there that you'll have to link into. At least I'm going to try to. If I don't, go to the show notes and there'll be a follow-up. I'll either get it on this episode or I'll put it in there somewhere. But I'm going to be talking to him about his thoughts on Chris using that apple. So that's rather informative. And then there's also going to be a follow-up about apple identification. So stay tuned to that. I imagine after I come back from CiderCon, I'll have a better idea where I'm going to be able to put that segment where I discussed with him how to, or at least his steps for identifying an apple. And it is fascinating. So some really cool stuff there. But this is it for now. I got to go pack my bags, take the dog for a walk, be at home a little bit before I head out to Portland, Oregon, and hopefully see you. And if I don't see you, well, I hope to see you soon in Ciderville. This is Rhea Windcaller, and I'll let John take it out from here.
Thank you very much, and thank you for listening, and please listen to Cider Chat next time.
Thank you so much, John.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Awesome.